This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The bones were found during an 11-year excavation under St. Peter's Basilica that led to an announcement in 1950.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Thanks for joining me. There's a lot to get into. I want to address Mary in Oregon. Chris Greyson is with me. We'll get back to her. Just coming up in a moment, just to let you know what's happening here. There's a story that broke, and I want to give you clarity on this, too, with three Italian researchers who are now expressing doubt as to whether or not the bones of St. Peter actually lie below the Rome Basilica where he's honored. You know, and you might have been there. You might have prayed there at St. Peter's Cathedral there in Rome. I mean, it's an amazing basilica, I should say. I'll tell you what they believe, and we'll share the incredible story of the finding of the bones of St. Peter that were long gone. But if you're just tuning in, Mary was listening to us in Oregon. She's an immigrant. She comes to this country. She was attracted to it by the many wonderful attributes that are America, the freedoms, the opportunities, the liberties, the education, the medicine, the economics that we have here. I mean, America is a great nation. And she was listening to Chris Greyson and I. My apologies, Chris, to you. I was saying Greyson. It's Greyson. It's good to have you back with me. Chris is a former NFL quarterback, a wonderful athlete, and a very devout Catholic who's taught, you know, Catholic theology and morality in the past. And when he came on, he talked a little. We were talking about the NFL wanting to go gay. There are a lot of people who struggle with same-sex attraction. And Chris, I was pointing out that the church, and as I know you were quoting the catechism a little bit earlier, and I think you probably have the number in front of you there, and you can go through what the church teaches on that, is very clear on how no unjust discrimination should be leveled, and how we don't know the origins of homosexuality, and that, you know, in some ways that those who embrace whatever the cross is in their life, if you know, as a heterosexual man, I've got to be faithful and chaste in my state in life, and so do those who have same-sex attraction. If we do that, we can achieve great virtue and great Christian perfection. But I'll let you address Mary on this issue, because, you know, I hope it doesn't come off as being unloving or uncharitable. But, you know, we also have to speak the truth, too, when it comes to these issues, and that's not always perceived that way.
Yeah, and yes, and thank you, Mary, for that call. I mean, I think, you know, it took a lot of courage for her, and know that this is what it's all about, is having these open conversations about this, and know that we really do love having you call Relevant Radio and be able to discuss this so that she can know the truth. And so I, you know, because I taught theology for a while, this was an issue that always came up. And so I kind of have it earmarked in my catechism. And so it's paragraphs 2357 through 2359 that the Catholic Church addresses this cross, as you mentioned, and it calls everyone to chastity, those that are heterosexual and those that are homosexual. And it says here, they do not choose, meaning the people that have this homosexual attraction, they do not choose their homosexual condition. For most of them, it is a trial. They must be accepted with respect, compassion, and sensitivity. Every sign of unjust discrimination in their regard should be avoided. Now, that is straight from the catechism, quote, end quote, and that is the teaching. And so that's what we're trying to do. But we cannot, as Catholics, also go along with it. And it's kind of the old saying, you know, hate the sin, love the sinner, right? And so if someone has that attraction, part of loving a person is telling, yeah, that's wrong. Like, you can't tell them if someone's hurting someone, bullying someone, like, that's right. And of course, we're going to say, hey, you can't do that, right? But that's what our secular culture is telling everyone. Like, yeah, it's okay. It's good to do that. It's good, you know, like, no, it's not. And unfortunately, because what love is, telling people the truth. Yeah. And the truth is, like, if we have one mortal sin on our soul, and it doesn't matter if you're homosexual, heterosexual, whatever, if you have one mortal sin on your soul, we're not going to be living with God for eternity. And that's the ultimate love, is trying to get people to repent and say, yeah, I'm sorry, God, and then live eternity with God. And that's I think all our goals as Christians is get ourselves there and to get our families there and to get others there.
All right. Mary, I know you're here. I'll give you final thoughts for Chris as well.
Oh, thank you so much. No, I do understand telling people the truth in love. It is just that there's so many suicide rates that are so high in the church because children don't understand that they are loved, that they should know who they are in Christ first, that homosexuality is a behavior, right? The, like you said, the homosexual is the person and homosexuality is the behavior. But once we bring people to Christ, but how do we bring people to Christ when we use such hateful language? And I don't know what you hear when you listen, but when I listen, I don't hear the love that comes from the church, even from the immigrant standpoint, even from the racial standpoint, where America in itself, I don't think, has had a really honest conversation about the atrocities that have happened. And I think that we ignore it. I have people that say to me, don't say you're a black woman. Don't say you're an immigrant. You are just a person like everybody else. But that means that people haven't really lovingly engaged on a day-to-day basis with the life that I'm living daily. That makes people that even serve who say that this is not why I'm serving in the world. Right. And in my country, people die because they don't they go against the government, or they even when it's true, even when it's the truth, right? This country is really open where people can protest and people can say, I am not free and I am not treated equally. And I would love for my life to matter because my life doesn't matter. Because when you see a man being killed on the pavement in the heat of Minneapolis, that happens in the US and the whole world took notice. So yeah. These things are happening, but I think that we are not having an honest all-around conversation about the history of racism in this country. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you are a racist, but if you're not engaging with me and in a loving way as a black person, as an immigrant, to say, tell me your story, show me what it is. Just saying I have a black friend and I hug my black friend who comes from the hood is not enough. Have you been to their house? Have you sat down and actually understood what generational trauma has done? Have they received any trauma-informed care? Every time there's a shooting, kids do get counseling before they go mm-hmm. back to school. Right. Black folks have received none of that. Indian folks have received none of that. Everyone is like, yeah, we're free. Let's move along and let's not talk about these divisive issues. The inability and the refusal to talk about these things is racism. And so those are the things as Christians that I really want us to challenge ourselves to go there with these conversations and not have this divisive, one-sided conversations that people on the left, people on the right, I'm nowhere. I'm an immigrant. I'm not on the left. I'm not on the right. But I am a Christian, and I do understand some things that are conservative, and I do understand some things that are liberal. We can't just have one conversation where I'm conservative and I'm liberal and you're leftist. Don't disrespect the flag. No, we're saying this flag is not representing me, and I would love for the flag to represent me as well.
All right. Hey, Mary, first of all, I hope you know you are loved and you are welcomed here, and I am really grateful for your honesty and your eloquence. I'm glad to call you a fellow American. And Chris, I'm going to allow you to respond. I mean, she did mention, have you been one-on-one with your black teammates? You know, you heard her comments. I won't restate them all, but I'll let you respond.
Yeah, you know, I have been one-on-one and been in situations. Now, did I go to their house? And no, I haven't. I have gone back, you know, even back in college with some of my teammates and stuff and saw where they lived and it didn't make me think any less or more. I love my teammates and I would do anything for them. And again, it was black or white. So is there some injustices out there? Absolutely. And should they be talked about? Yes. And I want to apologize to if there's anyone in the church who's not, you know, talking charitably to you or your family. I think that's, you know, because if you know the people that I listen to from the church, you know, you think of, you know, Bishop Robert Barron, you know, some of these great Catholics who understand and get it. You know, Father Michael Schmitz and just all these great priests and bishops that, you know, talk on relevant radio. I, I don't know if I've ever heard anyone talk uncharitably about an issue like racism or stuff, but I'm certain there are people out there that you have heard, Mary. And so I'm sorry that you had to hear that, because that certainly isn't the church, and that's not what Jesus Christ wanted, you know. So, but, you know, just know that we thank you for calling Relevant Radio and giving us your perspective.
And it's so well said. And I'm glad for this dialogue. That's really what this is about. And you know, I stand corrected. If I come off as being uncharitable, I always say I don't want to do that. I want to speak the truth in love. And that's really what this is all about. And I often, when I evaluate these situations, I think, how would Christ address that? But Chris, sometimes, you know, you have to speak the truth and it doesn't always resonate well. You know, it doesn't. But to Mary's point too, I mean, I am sick of the partisan flag being waved. People are conservative or liberal, they're Democrat or they're Republican, you know, and like Mary, and I think like you, I mean, our Catholic faith bridges the gap on a lot of different issues. But I'm grateful for your time too, Chris. Thank you for being here. Mary, thank you for your call. I do have to leave it right there because I've got another issue I've got to get to, and I'm grateful for the exchange today. Chris, if people want to get in touch with you or follow you, is there a way to do that? You have a Twitter account or anything you want to plug?
Yeah, no, I really don't. I'm pretty simple. I do my, I'm a teacher and I'm coach and, family guy and stuff like that. So
well, we'll get
I try
some prayer
to stay
for
on
you,
social
then.
Media.
We'll get some prayer.
Thank you.
So everybody can say Hail Mary for you and
it.
For your family. Let's catch up again soon. It's been way too long. I really appreciate you being here.
That's true.
God bless you. That's Chris Greisen. As I said, just a wonderful Catholic, a man who's taught the faith, and also a man who's a professional athlete who loves the country and loves the sport of football. He played for Dallas. He played for Arizona, and of course. You know, we're addressing not only what's going on in the NFL, but in the Olympics, and we'll talk much more about that as well. But I have to take a short pause. I'll be back with more. Stay with me.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Keeping it relevant, it's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Look, I love history. You know that, right? I love it. I never can get enough of it. I love, as a former documentarist, everything from the History Channel to Nat Geo to Discovery. And fascinated by, of course, our faith and what archaeology ultimately reveals. Yeah, I've had a friend of the show who's often joined me to talk about different saints. He wrote a book called Saints Behaving Badly, which is one of my favorites. It's actually on my bookshelf. And he wrote a book on Pope Francis, the Pope from the End of the Earth, and of course wrote a piece on a book called Stealing Lincoln's Body. It was actually turned into a two-hour documentary on the History Channel. He just came out with a new book, and I was talking to him during the break. I said, man, I hope this becomes a documentary because it's going to be great stuff. It surrounds one of the biggest mysteries of the church's history, and that is, where were the bones of the first pope laid? Where were the bones of St. Peter? Now, we had relics of the apostles and, of course, lots of early saints, you know, but for many centuries, you know, people had very little idea where the first pope, where his remains were. But, you know, we weren't completely sure of it. There were ideas, there were a number of different, you know, possible places, but St. Peter's Basilica was supposed to have been built over them. But, you know, there was no physical evidence for that. And on top of that, no pope would allow excavations to take place underneath of it either, because underneath the old basilica that was there, or the new one that exists upon it today. But Pope Pius XII, he gave orders to allow for excavations underneath St. Peter's. And what he wanted, you know, he wanted it done under, he basically, I believe, did this under papal secret in case nothing was found. But I'll tell you what, that was a decision that was richly rewarded. And joining me today to share with you the hunt for St. Peter's bones, and one chronicler, one person who's read the book, says it reads like a thriller. It's a delight to have back to the program, Tom Crogwell. Hey, Tom, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Good to talk to you again.
Always a delight to have you. I love your work, bro. I do.
Thank you.
I love the angle you give with history, and I love our faith. I mean, everything from saints behaving badly to the bones of St. Peter. It's going to be fascinating. There's quite a story here. One reviewer said, as I said, your book reads like a thriller. I can't wait to get a copy of it because I want to read it. How can looking for a dead man's bone, especially somebody who lived 2,000 years ago, be anything like a thriller? You know, people think of Da Vinci Code. Give me the backstory here. Fill everyone in on what led you to this and really the drama that unfolded behind the search for the first pope.
Well, you know, it's, believe it or not, it's kind of like a Catholic Indiana Jones story because, you know, here's this treasure of great price and nobody knows where it is. And what happened was I got the inspiration for this in 2006 when I was visiting the Scavi, the excavations under St. Peter's, and I know you've been there too, and yeah. It's such an impressive, unforgettable experience because you go down a flight of stairs and all of a sudden you're in first century Rome.
Wow.
And it's just the coolest thing in the world. But in any case, what had happened was on the site of St. Peter's Square today was a Roman arena, and that's the place where St. Peter was martyred. In fact, if you've been to Rome or you've seen photographs of the square, there's a towering obelisk. Well, that obelisk was in the arena. St. Peter would have seen that the day he died. So there's an instant physical connection to the day of his martyrdom right there in St. Peter's Square.
Yeah.
Outside of the arena was a cemetery. And Christians, we don't know who, managed to retrieve his body and buried it in the cemetery. About 100 years later, one of the early popes decided to build a small, very humble mausoleum or tomb,
mm-hmm.
and he put the bones of St. Peter in this mausoleum. Flash forward to about 325, when Constantine, the first Christian emperor,
mm-hmm.
takes over. He decides to build a basilica over the tomb of St. Peter. And the way his architects designed it is that the high altar was raised up and there was a crypt. You know, you could walk down a flight of stairs and see and pray before the little tomb of St. Peter.
Hmm.
Well, over the centuries, you know, renovations, reconstruction, and that little opening got paved over.
Yeah.
And so centuries went by and nobody had seen the tomb, let alone the bones of St. Peter, in such a long time that all they had was the oral tradition that his tomb was right underneath the high altar.
Mm.
So, as you said in your introduction, the popes were reluctant to the point of absolutely forbidding anybody excavating to find the tomb because,
right.
A, they didn't want to face it if nothing was there.
But also in terms of history, too, because you go from Constantine in 325, 323, we became first Christian emperor, he built that church. I think it was Julius II, he ordered the demolition of that old church. And, you know, of course, we had this incredible construction of what we now have as St. Peter's Basilica, Michelangelo's Dome, and so many other things.
Right.
What happened there? Were they aware that Peter was below there when in the 16th century they decided to build St. Peter's Basilica as we now know it?
Again, you know, that was the oral tradition that had been passed down through the centuries, but Julius, like all of his predecessors, said no. This is not what this job is about. We're not hunting around for a tomb or the relics.
Mm-hmm.
So they positioned the high altar, the one that we see today under Bernini's magnificent bronze canopy,
right,
on the exact same spot as where Constantine's altar was. So they're preserving the tradition, right?
Right.
But like I said, nobody's seen it for maybe 1,400 years. And then in 1939, Pius XII is elected pope. He decides to renovate the grottos underneath St. Peter's. Put devotional chapels in it, make it a more appealing place for pilgrims to visit, and also open it up so there's more room to bury more popes.
Right.
And so the construction crew is going to lower the floor by about 1.5-2 feet. So they start digging. And one day, one of the excavators, his shovel doesn't hit dirt. Hmm. It hits air.
Wow.
And they call in the Vatican archaeologists, and they do an initial investigation, and they get Pius's permission to start excavating. And they discover a Roman necropolis, a city of the dead, a cemetery. The Romans preferred to build tombs that looked like little Roman houses. And the whole family could be buried there, including their favorite servants. And they found street after street after street of them.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I want to give people a visual, because you may not know. When you go to Rome, if you've ever been there, I mean, really, Rome is built over, you know, ruin after ruin. When you go down beneath St. Peter's, literally, and what blew me away by this was that there were streets, there yeah. were buildings, there were artifacts. I mean, it's like you are in another world. You leave the year 2014, and you're now down to, you know, the year, you know, 100 or 50 or even before that. It's
right.
It really is quite amazing how all that was preserved. That kind of blows you away.
Well, you know, what happened was that to level the ground, because the cemetery was in a ravine, and so Constantine told his builders, look, shave off the roof of all the mausoleums, fill the whole area with dirt so that the ravine is level, and we build the church right there.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah.
So that completely preserved this necropolis. And so, you know, they're down there, and they're doing this work, and it's going on for a couple of years now. And the archaeologists, they can't help themselves. They're not only archaeologists, they're all priests. And they say, you know, wouldn't you just love to go dig in that direction and see if we can find St. Peter's tomb? And Pope Pius listened to their arguments and decided, all right, this is the time. Let's do this. And he gave them permission. And he said he had two requirements. Absolute secrecy, no leaks to the public. And secondly, that nothing that they did down there would interfere with the liturgical life that was going on in the basilica. Nothing could change.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a long, long process. And one day, in 1942, they found this humble little tomb right underneath the altar. And, you know, they're, like I said, they're Catholic priests. They're kind of excited, but mm-hmm. they're also professionals. So they're, you know, keeping their scholarly judgment going. And then they see the wall is covered with inscriptions,
yeah.
which they're used to, because Rome, the early Christians, scratched inscriptions on the tombs of saints or near the tombs of saints mm-hmm. all over Rome, the catacombs, every place.
Right. Well, let me ask you, is there... Go ahead, Peter. I'm sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
They see two words in Greek, Petros Ini, which means Peter is inside.
Wow.
And now they're blown away.
That's amazing. And they're just, they are assuming, based on oral tradition, that this is the fisherman, the first pope, the follower of Christ, the one who denied him three times, right?
Yes. I mean, they're obviously going to do a whole lot more study.
Yeah.
But all of them, I mean, they can hardly contain themselves.
Wow.
Because, you know, this is pay dirt. This is, you know, finding the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, the whole, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It's an amazing moment in their lives. It's the culminating archaeological achievement of their lives.
That's amazing. Is there any doubt at all that the bones really are St. Peter's? Has anyone raised substantial objections as to whether or not the archaeology or the history or the theology that was followed was indeed accurate?
They've tried, but here are the problems that they run into. First of all, absolutely clearly established from ancient sources, unbroken belief, faith, tradition, record, whatever you want to call it, that the Christians of Rome believed that this was Peter's tomb, that his relics were in there, and they came there to pray. Secondly, this is the part I really love, and this is so unusual if you've ever studied mm-hmm. relics in the history of the church.
Yeah.
No other place in the world at any time claimed to have the tomb and bones of St. Peter.
Wow.
Not Antioch, not Jerusalem, no place, just Rome.
You know, that's interesting because I saw a documentary on John the Baptist, who I have a special devotion to.
Yeah.
And there are people who claim to have his relics in two different places. They think they recently found his head, though, which is kind of interesting. But well, so no one has ever, in all of the 2,000 years of Christianity, claimed to have the bones of Peter.
Right, exactly. Wow. Nobody. No place. John the Baptist is fascinating because in the Middle Ages, everybody wanted to possess his skull. So there are, I did a book on relics a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I found eight different places that claimed it. And the book was, the manuscript was being copy edited, and all of a sudden there was a news report that they'd found a ninth.
Wow.
in Romania or Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm.
So I revised the entry.
Wow.
It was, you know, that was the one everybody wanted. You know, just like nails of the from the true cross.
Yeah, right.
The Catholic Encyclopedia that came out in the 19-teens did a nose count and found 32.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they also say that about the true relics of the cross. I mean, there's a bunch of them around, and people say if you took all the slivers that people are claiming are the true relics, you could build an ark. You know, you could build a boat out of that. I mean, is that indeed true? I know in the Middle Ages there was a lot of selling of relics.
Yes.
So the church places great emphasis on relics, though, don't they? And you wrote a book, as you know, over the weekend, thieves broke into a small church in Italy. They stole a reliquary containing a bloodstained cloth from Pope John Paul II. It's
yeah.
really tragic. Why does the church have this emphasis on relics? Why do we keep parts of these dead people and their bodies? Peter's bones, John's head, the nails that held Christ to the cross.
Well, first of all, about the pieces of the true cross,
yeah.
One of the things I discovered was that in the 19th century, there was one of those independently wealthy French, you know, independent scholars. He was a Frenchman in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided to you know, he had nothing to do all day. he decided that he would track down as many fragments of the true cross as he could and find out what their measurements were. And when he was done, he allowed himself, like, you know, 10-20% for margin of error,
right.
And ones that are missing or destroyed or lost. And he discovered that the existing pieces of the true cross would not build a cross large enough to accommodate an adult male.
Wow.
So it's, you know, so the wow. Ark or the battleship or whatever, which, mm-hmm. by the way, our friend Erasmus was the first one to come up with that.
That's funny.
A good Catholic boy, no less.
Yeah, right.
is a good punchline, but it's not true.
That's great. So there's not, even if I gathered all the so-called relics that are out there,
right.
It wouldn't be enough to crucify a man.
No, you could maybe build a rowboat, but that would be about it in terms of nautical stuff.
Wow, you know, I actually have been given one of those crosses with a small sliver of the true cross.
Oh my gosh, what a prize.
Yeah, I want to give it, you know, rather than keep it in my home, I want to actually give it to either the Shrine of Our Lady of Good Help, where it first approved apparition site, where other people can enjoy it, or to the relevant Radio Nativity, the chapel. So, but yeah, because I think those things should be shared if they're so rare. But, you know, I was always... And then there's paperwork that came with it and everything. I got it before the church has recently banned, getting relics like that, right? Because yeah. I had this 25 years now.
Yeah. You know. See, the problem that the church has always run into is, all right, the relic is in private hands. That individual mm-hmm. is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the family may not know what it is.
Right.
The family may not be practicing and not care. It gets tossed out. It goes to an antique store.
Right.
That happens quite a lot.
Ends up on eBay.
It winds up on eBay. And, you know, I've heard some pretty lively debates among priests and lay Catholics. So if you go on eBay and buy mm-hmm. the relic, is that the sin of simony where you're paying money for something sacred, or are you rescuing...
See, I would think you're rescuing the relic. Now, if I took my relic and I put it on eBay and I sold it, that would be simony. But if I, because yeah. I struggle with that too. I saw, what was it? It was one of those. It was a cable show, the one where you could Pawn Stars. Is that it?
Yes,
Pawn Stars.
I saw that episode.
Where they came in and they had a relic. I think of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton or something.
Yeah.
And they didn't know what it was. The Pawn Star dudes were all freaked out because they thought it'd be cursed or they didn't want to buy anything that's dead.
Right.
And the girl who came in, you know, translated the Latin. She wasn't very knowledgeable. I didn't think in terms of knowing what a relic is in the church. And in the end, they didn't buy it, which was a smart thing. But things like that end up in pawn shops or eBay. And I do think it's tragic. I mean, because you're right. People don't know what their father or their grandfather or somebody may have had in their personal collection. You know?
Right. So I come down with you on the side of rescue him.
Yeah.
But the church has had this tradition, and it didn't start with us. It goes back to the Old Testament. If you look in the second book of Kings, there's this little story that of a man who died. He's Jewish, of course. His family decides to bury him as close as they possibly can to the prophet Elisha. They're lowering the body into the grave,
right,
and the body touches the bones of Elisha, and the man comes back to life.
Yeah.
So then you go into the Acts of the Apostles, and we read that the first Christians would bring cloths and scarves and veils to St. Paul and have him touch them. And then they would take these, what we would call third-class relics, back to someone in their family who was sick or possessed by evil spirits, and the person would be healed by the grace of God through the intervention, if you want to say, of the relic. So it's ancient, and biblical.
Yeah, that's true. Interesting. My guest today is Tom Crogwell. You can check him out at his website, thomascrogwell.com, thomascrogwell.com. And Tom, it's good to be with you. Your subtitle to your book is How the Relics of the First Pope Were Lost and Found, and then Lost and Found Again. Can you? I don't want you to give the book away, but can you give me a Reader's Digest version of how they were lost and found twice?
Well, you know, they were lost because, as I said, nobody had seen them in centuries. And then in 1942, the archaeologists find them. The night that the tomb was uncovered, the administrator of St. Peter's Basilica, he and the archaeologists didn't get along.
Hmm.
And at night, this elderly Monsignor would go down with the foreman of the work crew and look around. He was always afraid that human remains would be tossed out with the dirt that had been dug up. So if he saw any bones, he would put them in these wooden boxes and send them to one of the storage units in St. Peter's for reburial later after the excavation was done. And he's walking by this little tomb, and he looks inside and he sees human bones, and he says to the to the foreman, collect those, please. Well, guess whose they were? And it goes in a wooden box and goes into storage. Now, you know, the guy who did it labeled every box so that people would know where they were supposed to go back to,
right,
but he didn't put St. Peter's tomb on it because he didn't know it was St. Peter's tomb.
Wow, that's amazing.
And so, the archaeologists are so disappointed because, you know, there's nothing inside.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, with just a casual conversation between that foreman and another archaeologist, and he says, you know, there was a funny thing happened.
Wow.
And so that's how they were found again.
That's so cool. Hey, I only got about a minute left. I'm just curious. Does the church do any DNA cataloging of this so somebody can say, hey, I'm a descendant of St. Peter? Or do they do anything like that?
With something like that, no.
Yeah.
I think with more modern saints, yeah, I think they could if they wanted to.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, it's neat stuff. Look, I hope the book does well. Where can people get it? All major bookstores?
You can go to all the major bookstores. You can go to Amazon.com. You can go to my website, thomascrogwell.com, and just hit the buy button.
All right.
My favorite button on the whole website.
Sure. Thomascrogwell.com, folks. That's CRAUGHWELL.com.
That's
thomascrogwell.com. Type in St. Peter's Bones, you'll find it too that way, I'm sure, into a search. One of a number of books. The other one I like too is Saints Behaving Badly. But I really hope Discovery or History, they end up turning this into a documentary as well. I think it'll be a great story to share. Today, of course, is the Solemnity of St. Peter's and Paul. St. Peter and Paul. I'm going to say St. Peter's. I often think about the Basilica. Peter, of course, the first pope. And, of course, Paul, one of the greatest evangelists in church history. But I'll take a few of your calls. When we come back, I want to talk about popes who were saints, right? A lot of popes. You know, how many were saints? We'll take a look at that. You probably think of John Paul II. You can mention quite a few. But let me take Sister Teresa. She's listening in New Jersey. She's a Franciscan sister. She wants to jump in on the conversation. Sister, good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon, Drew. I just wanted to let you know, I was listening to this guest of yours going on about this, and when I lived 10 years in Rome. I was a theology student and translator for my community, but I had the opportunity to go down and visit what are known as the scavi. That means excavations.
Yeah.
Okay, a priest friend of mine got me a couple of tickets, and another sister and I went. Very few people can go down at a time, like no more than 15, because when you actually go down there, it's like way, way, way under the basilica. He said many people think when they come into St. Peter's, go up to the main altar, they look down and they see that big mosaic of Christ. That he said, if you look at it, it's off center.
Uh-huh.
He said that's actually the apse of the previous basilica. They didn't destroy them. They built on top of them.
Wow.
Okay. And he said that many people look at there's like a box. Their metal box, they think that the bones of Peter in there. That's actually where they store the pallia, which in fact the Holy Father was giving today to the Metropolitan Archbishops.
Right.
Anyway, he took us down to where you could actually see where the bones of Peter are. I saw them, and he explained how they got lost. They were hidden in a safe for a number of years because nobody knew what they were, who they were. But he said there was a woman archaeologist who came on about 12 years later. She got a hold of those bones, and they studied them, and they said the bones are obviously of a 60-something-year-old man who did hard labor. He could have been a fisherman. And they find tracings of purple dye and gold. Now, purple was the color that was worn only by the emperor, so the early Christians would have used very fine cloth, he said, to wrap the bones of St. Peter and keep them there, okay? And I guess, I don't know what happened after a while, maybe it got, but anyway, the church after a while, the Pope said put them back, they did. So I was just absolutely awed. You just see bones sitting on top of something between two, you know, layers in the cement, bricks, whatever.
You know, Sister, what amazed me, and I had the great privilege of going and taking that scavi tour many, many years ago as well.
Did you?
Yeah,
great.
And it was the Father Seraphim Michelangelo, who was the vice postulator for the cause of St. Faustina when we were in Rome, was able to get me tickets, and the two of us went down there. But it is amazing. There's a whole city right beneath there. I mean, you see buildings, you know.
The necropolis.
You see artwork that was done in front. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. What is hidden below that? So it's a fascinating story, and it's a great tour for anyone who wants to go. I guess your Italian's pretty
good
now.
Read the graffiti.
Huh? Yeah, read.
Oh, I'm fluent in it. I am.
I'll tell you something else.
You know, pardon? Oh, sometimes I do. Yeah. Yes, I love the people. My mother's side is all Italian.
But
I met my relatives when I was over there. But here's something else: a lot of people don't realize is that for about 70 years, the bodies of Saints Peter and Paul were hidden. They were taken away because there was an outbreak of persecution, and they were hidden in the catacombs of St. Sebastian. And when you go take a visit there, they'll show you the graffiti on the wall. Peter is here. Paul is here. They scratch it in very bad Greek or, you know, street Latin, whatever. But there's a whole history of that. It's fascinating. It really is.
I love it. Well, Sister, thanks for calling in. Thanks for sharing that. And
you're welcome, and thank you for bringing on that guest. It just brought back, I've seen it for like 25 years, but it was amazing, absolutely amazing.
All right. Hey, what is it? Buonasera for you right now, sister? Is it Buonasera?
Buonasera. Buonasera.
Right. Have a great one. Always good talking to you. Thank you, sister.
You too.
All right. I need to take a short pause. God bless you. When we come back, let's honor St. Peter. I mean, the man who walked on water, right? Who died for Christ. A great pope and a martyr for the faith, but there were many vicars of Christ that would follow in Peter's footsteps, many of them elevated to the altars. We'll talk about that. It was not a good time to be a pope early on, right? You know how many of the first popes? 33 of the very first popes were martyred. You know, you became a pope, you're thinking, uh-oh, it could be a death sentence. When we come back, I'll give you a little history, all right? And Brian O'Neill is going to be joining me, too. We only have a few minutes, but stay tuned, and feel free to join me anytime if you want as well. I'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Welcome back. Today, the great feast of the solemnity of two wonderful saints, Peter, I can relate to him. Of course, the great convert Paul, right? Great evangelist of the early church. Peter preached the good news, and that's a clear duty of the Pope. And he just wasn't as successful as Paul was. I don't mean to diminish that. Both of them ended up martyrs, but Paul, man, what an evangelist he was and the writings he left behind. Paul was beheaded. Peter, of course, was crucified upside down. He didn't feel worthy to suffer or die the same way that the Lord suffered. But as I was saying, the first 33 popes, they lost their lives. They were martyred. Can you imagine that, being a pope? I mean, it's a phenomenal call, right? Vicar of Christ, walking in the footsteps of Peter. But, you know, after 15 were martyred, and then you're the 16th and the 17th and the 18th, all the way up to the 30th, 33rd, you talk about faith and love for the church, right? 33 popes were martyred, and the first 35 popes were named saints. So the first non-sainted pope doesn't appear in about the middle of the 4th century, and then you skip a couple, and then 18 more saints come along, and more recently, we've had some great saints that you and I are probably more familiar with, Pius X and John the 23rd and Paul the 6th, right, who wrote Humanae Vitae, and, of course, the great St. John Paul the 2nd. And, you know, there are other causes underway right now, like Pius the 12th, his cause is underway. I'm sure he'll probably be raised to the altars. And John Paul the 1st, who reigned, what, 33 days? There was nothing but... being a pope and a saint are things that should, you almost think, go together automatically, right? But there are temptations that surround the office. Satan has great enmity, great hatred for the church. And, of course, we've had some popes who weren't the most virtuous. Let's put it that way. You might be familiar with the Borgias and others. But I'm joined today by an author. His name is Brian O'Neill. He's a writer about the saints. He wrote a couple books, and if you have a fascination with the saints, check out 39 New Saints You Should Know. He also wrote a book called Saint Who, 39 Holy Unknowns, and wrote about the North American martyrs too, 150 North American martyrs that you should know. And he joins me today, great journalist and great author. And it's good to have you back, Brian. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Thanks for having me.
And thanks be to God. You know, we've had, 266 popes that have reached the level of holiness known as sainthood. We've got a wonderful legacy of popes in the church. Let's talk about those early chapters of popes. I mean, I always marvel at 33 men going to their death, knowing that if you're a pope, it normally does not end well. Being a pope in the early centuries was a dangerous job. Give me your analysis of that. I mean, why would anyone want to be pope, knowing that it's almost a certain death sentence?
Well, obviously, it was a calling, and, you know, the calling of the Holy Spirit to follow in the footsteps of Peter. There's that famous story of Peter hightailing it out of Rome at the start of the Neronian persecutions and seeing Jesus walking toward Rome and, Domine, Quo Vadis, Lord, where are you going? I'm going to suffer again for my people, which, you know, duly chastised, the duly chastened Peter turned his hide around and went back to this eternal city where, as you noted, he was crucified upside down. And, you know, if the first pope can do it, the first supreme pontiff, you know, little pontiff meaning a bridge, yeah, can do that, then obviously who am I to say no? And so, you know, when you've got such a great example, it really helps smooth the way, I would imagine.
Hey, answer about the 6th century, and I'd like your analysis of this. The sainted popes, they stopped coming. What changed? Was it the time? Was it something within the church? I mean, clearly, so many men lived lives of heroic virtue. Was that a time of not such great virtue? I mean, what happened around the 6th century?
Well, you know, the 6th century is when we have Gregory the Great. But when you have someone who is so outstanding, I imagine others kind of pale in comparison. It wasn't that these men weren't holy men. It's that the, you know, and some of them weren't, but it's that I'm having trouble speaking today. It's just that they, there were other things going on at the time that would maybe distract from, yeah, you know, a lot of the Christological heresies are kind of getting resolved. A lot of the, there's not as many councils. You know, Pope Gregory the Great, he's, like I said, in this time, but before him is Pope Leo the Great, mm-hmm. Who has a big hand in determining the Christ, true God and true man, which we take for granted today, right. But that was a huge, huge, huge heresy, or not heresy, but controversy back then. And there were a bunch of heretics who were saying, no, he's true God, but not true man, or he's true man, but not true God, and these sorts of things. And right. So all these great early popes got all these things worked out. And then, you start focusing on more on confessors like St. Right. Augustine and that sort of thing.
So Brian, speaking of the greats, just, people may not understand, why do you have, Leo the Great or Gregory the Great? Let's educate people on that a little bit. There were only, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong in this, but there were three sainted popes that were given that moniker, the Great. You have Leo the Great, Gregory the Great, Nicholas the Great. I mean, how does that title come about? Because I know many people, upon the death of John Paul II, began calling him St. John Paul the Great. Fill us in on the moniker, the title, how that comes to be, and how it gets assigned.
Well, it's the ones who are styled the Great are great because of the impact that they had on the institution and on Christendom itself. So not only did Leo the Great have a huge hand in providing the foundation for the Council of Chalcedon, which determined that Jesus Christ is true God and true man, the hypostatic union, but he also fought a bunch of other heresies that were popping up all over the place. Gregory the Great not only recaptured, if you will, in a spiritual sense, Spain and France for the papacy, because they had kind of gone off into their own orbit, but he also was the first to send out evangelists to England, and that's why it became the Catholic Christian country that it was for so many centuries. He was the one who brought in all these other European tribes into the Christian fold. Plus, he had such a huge impact on the way that we worship today. The Mass for up until 1969 was largely the Mass that Gregory had reformed and had implemented. So, and then Nicholas the Great, same sort of thing. Was just really fought for the holiness of the faith, right. And did so in a meaningful, impactful way.
Yeah. So John Paul II, you think that moniker is going to stick?
It's a great question. And, it brings up something else. You had mentioned that, sainthood and the papacy should kind of go hand in hand. Yeah. And you could think that because with the exception of Benedict the 15th and Pius the 11th, every pope going back to Blessed Pius the 9th in the middle of the 19th century has either become a saint, is a blessed, wow. Or is on their way towards in some stage of sainthood, like yeah. Leo the 13th recently became a servant of God, and and this sort of thing. So it's we've been really fortunate over the last century and a half or so to have these just amazingly holy popes. You have to go back over a century before then to find another sainted pope.
Yeah, if you look back just over the last 6 years or so, we're getting these sainted popes again. And I think there's something about the time in which you live too, and the grace that flows through the church and the guidance that we need. And that's why it's so important for us to pray for our pope, our bishops and our cardinals. I only have a moment or two left, but I want to make sure people get connected to your books. If they want to learn more about some of these great saints, I know you've written about them. What's the best way to get connected? What would you recommend?
I would recommend either they go to Amazon or to their local Catholic bookstore. Those bookstores are struggling with the pandemic and just with the change in how we access our information. So, always want to encourage people to go to them and give them your business. But yeah, Amazon and some of the other online retailers are another fine way of getting those books. Yeah. And there are 39 new saints you should know, Saint Who, 39 Holy Unknowns, and then 150 North American martyrs you should know.
All right. Thanks for writing so much about the Saints. We need them. We can be inspired by them. Brian, I'm grateful for your time. Thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you, Drew.
It's Brian O'Neill, author of those books. You can check him out. I only have about a moment or two left. If you missed any of the conversation today, feel free to just go to our social media accounts. If you go to the Facebook page, I hope you'll follow and like us there. We stay in touch with you there. Twitter's at Drew Mariani Show. And our podcasts, just go to relevantradio.com, type in my name, and you will find all of these conversations and more. We had a great conversation today, too. Patrick, before we wrap it up, you are a Raider fan, right?
Yes.
Even now that they play for Nevada, you're okay with that?
Well, yeah. Even Oakland, Las Vegas, San Antonio, I don't care.
So what do you make of the whole NFL controversy that has come up? And
with Nasib?
Yeah.
I really don't care in terms of as long as he gets sacks, he's the defensive end. He had 5 sacks last year, 2.5 sacks. As long as he performs in the field, doesn't really matter to me. I don't see it on the field when I see the whistle. So
yeah, so if people don't know what you're talking about, basically he came out and says
yes.
He's gay.
Oh, yeah, from a previous conversation, he did come out as gay. I don't really care.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way. You know, it's about the sport. It's about watching the game. All right, well, thank you, Patrick. We'll see how your Raiders do this year. Up against the clock, Cale Clark is straight ahead. Stay with us, okay? The conversation will continue there. And be sure to join me tomorrow. I'll be back in about 21 hours. We can hang out then. I'll give you a look at life. In fact, I'm going to be joined by an astronaut tomorrow. He's got a campaign to protect the Earth from asteroids. The scientists have found 11 of them that could threaten humanity. We'll talk about it.